My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.
Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life.
Hey, beloved listeners, it is just me, Ben, on the intro today for a variety of reasons. Don't worry. They're all good reasons. And before we get into our interview today, I just wanted to make you aware one more time, just once more, about Theology Beer Camp. It starts on Thursday, which hopefully you're listening to this before Thursday, October 17th, because that's when Theology Beer Camp starts. If you've been thinking about maybe making a last-minute trip to Denver, Colorado, I'd say that you should go for it. Theology Beer Camp, we're going to be there as one of the featured podcasts. It's in Denver, Colorado. It is I've never been to it, but it looks like it's going to be kind of a fun little mashup of theology and nerdery and fun. There's even like a Dungeons and Dragons session that some people are going to go to. There's a cosplay contest. There's going to be a camp, like a tent revival. Anyway, it looks to be all very fun, very tongue in cheek. But also, at the same time, very serious about, thinking theologically about the church and about the future of God's people. I'm excited to be there just to kind of, talk with everybody. One fun thing about Theology Beer Camp that I learned is that Trip Fuller, who organizes it, basically says to anybody who's going to come and speak at it that you cannot just come and speak and then kind of fly in, do your speaking thing, and then fly out. If you are going to come and speak at Theology Beer Camp, you have to be there for the whole time so that you can hobnob with the other scholars that are there and the podcasts and everybody else that's there. So anyway, I'm excited about it. Brian McLaren's going to be there. Ilya Delio is going to be there. Jörg Rieger is going to be there. Diana Butler Bass, Catherine Keller, a lot of other people that I'm excited to hear from and, you know, hopefully interact with. I think it'll be a lot of fun. I think there's going to be over 600 people there, and there'll be lots of quality craft beer if you're into that as well. So anyway, if you're thinking about making a last-minute decision to join us, I would encourage you to do so. If you want to, also, you can get virtual tickets now as well. So if you can't travel to Denver, Colorado, but you want to get in on the fun virtually, you can buy virtual tickets as well. If you want all the info, you can go to gravitycommons.com/theologycamp, gravitycommons.com/theologycamp, and use our code GravityHobbit to get $50 off your in-person registration. I'm not sure if that gets you any money off your virtual registration, but give it a try. Who knows? Might be fun. All right. That is probably all I need to let you know about. I'm going to be on a plane going to Denver on Thursday and back on Saturday. We are talking today with Emily P. Freeman. She is a spiritual director. She's a podcast host, and she's an author of several books. And she joins us today. The conversation we had with her is all about what to do when you start to feel a shift and have to decide if it's time to make a change, and to know how to make that change when the time is right. I've been through several seasons like this in my life. I'm sure that you have as well. Maybe you're in the middle of one, or suspect that you might be. This is the theme of Emily's book, How to Walk Into a Room, The Art of Knowing When to Stay and When to Walk Away. And her book and this conversation helps us to begin to uncover the silent, nuanced, and hidden arrows for anyone asking questions like, how do I know if it's time to move on? What if I stay and nothing changes? What if I leave and everything falls apart? Man, these are big questions. This book, How to Walk Into a Room, is one of the best 5 books on religion, according to Publishers Weekly. It is on the New Yorker's Best of 2023 list and is the winner of the Prose Award from the Association of American Publishers. So this is a well-accoladed book. Emily P. Freeman, who we talked to today, is the Wall Street Journal best-selling author of 5 books, including The Next Right Thing. As a spiritual director, workshop leader, and the host of the Next Right Thing podcast, her most important work is to help create soul space and offer spiritual companionship and discernment for anyone struggling with decision fatigue. Emily holds a master's degree in spiritual formation and leadership from Friends University. Let's get into it.
Emily, welcome to the Gravity Commons podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start out our conversation today about maybe your life, your journey, and not all of it, but the parts that are pertinent to why writing a book about leaving seemed prudent for you. What parts of your story make this book something that you felt you could write?
I would say when I think of my own life, I am more of a stayer than a leaver. And I say that knowing that we all have narratives of what it means to stay and what it means to leave. But in my heart, I'm like, I will be loyal to you forever. Yeah. And not just you, but also the way my furniture is laid out in this room, and also this town, and also every decision I've ever made, I want it to be like,
and that shirt from 1994 that you still
I have
rock.
Shoes from college. And my sister's like, how can you possibly still have shoes? But I'm like, I bought these shoes then, I like them now.
How could I abandon these precious? They have been loyal to me.
They've been with me through thick and thin. And I say that, however, when you look at my actual life, so my dad, fun fact, my dad was in radio. And so we moved around a lot when I was a kid. We lived in Iowa, Indiana, Michigan, South Carolina. And then my parents moved to Texas when I was in college. So they moved around even without me. And so even though I feel like I'm a stayer in my heart, my real life shows that I have done a fair amount of moving around and a fair amount of saying goodbye. And I think that, you know, thinking about the narratives that we all have about not just the decision, because it's like there's two things, right? There's the decision to stay or leave a place for whatever reason. But then there's also the identities that we attach to what it means to be someone who stays and what it means to be someone who leaves. And depending on your social location or your faith background or your family of origin, that all informs whether or not being a stayer or being a leaver is positive, negative, or neutral, right? Mm. And so I think when I look back, I had a lot of positive experiences leaving and trying new things. And it was hard and there was a lot of grief. But as a kid, I think I learned how to, I'm an introvert at heart, but I learned how to be extroverted so that I would still get invited to birthday parties because that was very important when you're 11 and also now when you're a grown up. So I've learned that. But I think there's also been times, though, when I have been in spaces that I really desperately wanted to stay in. But for various reasons, I had to take a really hard look at, is it time for me now to actually move on and make a change?
Yeah.
Emily, you use rooms as a metaphor for arenas in our lives. And I have reasons, but I would love for our listeners to hear you kind of double click on what are some of the reasons that we may avoid leaving rooms that we need to.
There are so many reasons, Christy. And I'll tell you what, this idea of rooms, I think it's a helpful metaphor to think about. Listen, if you meet me, you will know I do love a good metaphor. So here we are. The metaphor of our lives are a lot like a house, and every room of our lives tells a story. And some of the rooms that we're in are rooms that maybe we were born into, we prayed really hard for, we worked hard to get into, and we've been here all our lives. Other rooms are like, I was there for a sec, but it wasn't really the right room for me. But the question oftentimes that I think a lot of us find ourselves as we stand in the threshold of a doorway of a room is, what do I do if I'm in a room that maybe once was exactly right for me, but now I'm starting to question either I've changed or the room has changed or the people here have changed. But I think to answer your question, what can keep us here maybe past time or too long, or what makes it hard to walk out, is for some of those things that we've already said, which is, I prayed for a long time to know what my next right thing was. And I really thought I heard from God and my community, and I listened to what I most deeply desired, and it led me here. And so now I'm questioning that. So what does that mean? Not just about like me as a person. What does that mean also about my ability to hear from God? What does it mean about my own judgment and my own discernment? And so it's scary to question spaces that we worked really hard to get into or we prayed a really long time for, because it begins to bring into question our ability to hear and understand in this relationship that we hold most dear, either with the people close to us or with God.
I wish I would have read your book many years ago. Like, I wish you would have written it many years ago.
Me too.
Because I just think we need to hear that. Yeah. And we need to hear the permission that I think you give in this book as you make decisions, because so many of us are in that threshold, or we have been, and there's so much guilt and shame and crazy narratives that are in our heads about ourselves or our families or whatever, the church, that we need the permission. So thank you.
Yeah. I want to just call back to the jokes we made about shoes, but I have articles of clothing that I keep for nostalgia purposes. You know, this is the t-shirt I got at that concert. I don't wear it anymore. It just sits in my, and I see it once a month. And my wife, who is very Marie Kondo, she wants to like purge it, right? And I think that maybe by way of analogy, I have nostalgia for circles of belonging. Like you said, Emily, that either I have moved on from or the circle has moved from me. And it's really hard for me to acknowledge that because of the nostalgia I have for the importance that that room played in my life at a certain time. And that kind of, I don't know, belonging nostalgia, like it sort of haunts me, and it makes it more difficult to reckon with, okay, they are no longer standing where I'm standing. They've moved from me. So maybe it's worth like moving on. And I think you naming that helps me understand why it's hard for me sometimes to move on. So,
I wonder, Emily, you know, we've talked a little bit about some of the reasons why it's hard to move on. You know, there's a little bit of a foolishness that you've alluded to there, where we just feel a little bit like, oh gosh, I was so confident in this and now I'm not. Or I don't want to be known as a quitter. You know, I don't want to be thought of as flaky. You know, that kind of a thing. And so, and there's a lot of pain, you know, as Matt alluded to, that sort of, you know, starting over, you know, there's a lot of pain that we have to face and uncertainty. I wonder if you can just maybe dive into that a little bit. I wonder what it takes or what you've learned about how to face some of those tendencies that we have not to leave, and how to, you know, lean into leaving well.
What a beautiful question, Ben. And I'll tell you, when I think about leaving, all leaving is not created equally, right? I mean, we all know there are the types of leaving where it's more of an anticipated ending, where we're talking graduations, retirements. Mm-hmm. And these are the times when we toast, when we have parties. And it's because communally, And culturally, we all know and have decided this thing has come to an end. And I think one of the reasons why that type of leaving is not that it's not bittersweet or there's not things to grieve, but I think the fact that it's communal and everyone agrees makes it easier to let it go. Like the, right. This was a time and now that time has passed and we can celebrate it and toast it. And we have our built-in rituals that help us let it go. But then there are two other types of leaving I think that can be more difficult. One is the kind that is a forced ending or a forced leaving where you want to stay, but maybe you're let go from the job or you're kicked out of the friend group and you might not even know why. And that has its own unique set of griefs and things that are going to need to be worked through. Similarly, the third type of leaving or ending is the kind that I probably spend the most time talking with people about. And that is those discerned endings, which is kind of what we've talked about already, which is when I'm the one who has to decide whether or not it's time to go or stay, when it's not so obvious, I wasn't fired, I'm not being kicked out, and it's not necessarily communally understood that it's time. But there, so now we're not just dealing with the grief of this thing possibly coming to an end. Now we're also dealing with my own ability to make a good decision. Yeah. And there's a lot of pressure that can come with that. But I think with all these three endings, I think there's one thing that they all could have in common, and that is they all need to be marked. Once the ending, once we recognize like this is an ending and it's time to move forward or to move on, to move forward, however you like to say that, we have to mark these endings. And we also need to recognize, I think it's really, it's helped me a lot to recognize the ending doesn't get to define the whole story. That how a thing ends does not necessarily give any indication to how good or terrible the thing was while I was living it. It's just over now. And so it's helpful for me to enter into a practice, a sort of a two-part practice of naming what is it that I'm bringing with me as I leave this room, whether it was forced, discerned, or anticipated. What am I bringing with me? And what am I leaving behind? The same way you would do if you're moving from a house, there are some things that you bring with you, like the boxes of special things and all of your belongings that you can pack. But then there are things you have to leave behind when you move from a house, right? Like the fireplace where you had Christmas. You can't take that with you. The backyard where your one-year-old learned to walk. And so I think in the same way in our metaphorical rooms, I have literally, y'all, made lists of here are the things that this thing ended terribly. But then also it was a really good thing for a really long time. So I'm going to make a list of the gifts that I'm bringing with me. And that could be the person who I have become. That could be people who I met that I never would have met any other way. That could be I learned what not to do as a leader. And I'm going to bring that with me as I walk out. But then there are other things that I have to leave behind. So I think that making those two lists, like physically writing with your actual hand on actual paper, and even if it's just a bullet pointed list, what am I bringing with me and what am I leaving behind? That can be helpful for just our own spiritual formation as we move through our life in order to mark the fact that this did come to an end. Otherwise, we're going to be carrying around this sort of non-ending inside us. And probably it's going to come out in sideways ways, like frustration or, random tears or, whatever way your personality expresses grief. It's going to come out one way or the other. And I recommend that we participate with it on purpose.
Yeah.
We'll be right back.
Listener, this ad is different than other ads. Ben and I are going to be at a conference and we want you to join us. We did a national gathering for Gravity in 2017. We did a grief kind of retreat last summer. And we've been looking for ways to gather this year with all y'all because we love spending time with you. And we got invited into something called Theology Beer Camp, which is October 17th through 19th in Denver, Colorado. We're joining a host of other people from around the country. We're going to do some podcasting there. Ben, who all is going to be there?
I'm excited about Ilya Delio.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
The unbearable wholeness of being changed my life.
Yeah, incredible. Brian McLaren's going to be there. Diana Butler-Bass, Brian Zond.
We know him.
Other folks.
Yeah, there's going to be lots of podcasting, lots of keynote speaking, and lots of time to hang out. There's going to be a lot of relational time, and we may even record some podcasts. We'd love to record podcasts, even with you, listener. They've given us a discount code for all of our listeners because we are a sponsor. Yeah. So if you go to gravitycommons.com/theologycamp, and use the code GravityHobbit. That'll give you an idea of the kind of gathering we're doing here. You get $25 off tickets. Prices go up soon, so register today.
Yep. Beer is optional, by the way.
Yeah, but theology isn't.
Theology isn't, but the beer is optional. All right, that code again, or the website again, friends, is gravitycommons.com/theologycamp. And make sure to use our code GravityHobbit, two Bs, to get $25 off tickets. Hope to see you there.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, a 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life God shares with us. It's a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence, and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us towards holistic flourishing. More transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people all over the world in this formation framework, and it has helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives, to learn how to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
Let's get back to the show. Emily, I'm thinking about my mom died suddenly 5 years ago, and I had to leave kind of the room of relating to her as a mom and as somebody who I could talk to and call. And a friend of mine gave me a candle, and it was an item or a totem like you're describing to mark and memorialize the end of my mom's life. And his advice to me was, do this on the 13th of every month for as long as you need to remember that your mom is no more, and also to remember, like, to leave behind and to take away. And I didn't know I needed that at the time. And honestly, some months on the 13th, I am not want or, you know, juiced to do that. But it's been such a helpful thing. And I think one of the gifts of your book is you actually walk through some of the stuff in the book with questions and give us ideas on how to do this. And I think that's what we need, Emily, is like, we just don't know how to do these things or that they even need to be done. I wonder if you could share a story in your life about leaving that maybe could serve as like legitimacy or permission for others to leave, but also like, how did you then leave behind and take away in that situation?
You know, one that comes immediately to mind is I co-founded a membership community for writers about 7 years ago now. And at the time it was, you know, it's like one of those internet things that you kind of start and you're like, will this work? We don't know. We're just going to try it. Yeah. And we tried it. And for many years, it was kind of a side hobby. It was me and my sister, my dad, and then a friend of ours who's kind of in marketing. And so the four of us kind of went to a partnership together and we did it on the side. But then, you know, right before COVID, we kind of got a little bit more serious about it and it started to grow. And then during COVID, it was a membership community for writers. And guess what everybody had time to think they wanted to do during COVID was write a book. And so we were like doing great, right? During COVID, it was really a really lucrative time for the business. But what also happened was slowly over time, what was a side business became a center business. And I found that some of the things that I was, you know, when I look at my own core values and the things that I feel like I'm good at and the things that I really wanted to spend my time doing, more and more, because our team was growing and this work was growing, I was spending less time doing the things that I felt that I was excellent at. And I was spending more time doing things that I was good at, but not maybe it was good work. It maybe wasn't my best work. And so I was doing a lot of managing rather than doing the making, which is where I feel like I come most fully alive. And now listen, we all have seasons of our life like that. Like, work is work, jobs are jobs. we can't love everything about everything that we do. But I just started to ask myself some questions during those, you know, years of this has become kind of my full-time job. Oops, we have a business now. And I had to begin to ask myself some really honest questions. And one of them was, well, you wanted this. Like you started the thing. No one forced you to start a business. And look, poor you, it's successful. So how could I question? You know, it's like that voice. We all have that like sarcastic voice probably in our heads that's kind of, you know, when we start to ask some really important human questions and enter into that healthy human rhythm of leaving rooms and finding new ones, there's always a critic at the door, right? Who's like, come on, who do you think you are? And of course, I was experiencing some of that. And there were other things happening in our life. And there were, you know, business relationships and other things that were kind of making me question, is now the time? But y'all, that sort of questioning period, because I was sort of starting to question if this was the right work for me in 2019. And when the pandemic hit, it became very clear that this was not the time for me to exit or to make a change. Like I had to kind of dig in and do the thing. So it was a full 3 years. It was a 3-year process of discernment and of like waiting for the right time and wanting to end well and conversations with my business partners. You know, there were just, it just wasn't time yet. And so it was a full 3 years before I could finally, you know, we kind of came up with a plan and two of us or three of us exited and one partner bought us out and it ended well in that way. But I say all of that because that was something I helped to co-start. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but we had these writers who are in the community. Some of them came because they found it through me. And so there was a lot of potential guilt or not wanting to feel like I'm abandoning a community that has gathered and it was a really beautiful community. There's also a questioning of like, am I doing the right thing? And will a grown-up please show up and tell me what to do? Uh-oh, I'm the grown-up. And so that whole part, but it was not just, you know, I think so many times we want our decisions to be like, here's a question I have and here's the answer. And, you know, school kind of teaches us that that's the way things go, but life has shown us that usually it's much less question and answer, and it's more question and then arrow, arrow, arrow for maybe even many years to our next right thing that eventually, hopefully, maybe you get an answer. But sometimes it's just you're following arrows to your next right thing and trusting that God is, I mean, I trusted God was with me, but I had to learn that, you know, God was going to be with me no matter which way I went. And that can be both comforting and extremely maddening because I just kind of wanted to know the right answer. Yeah. But that was a really huge room that I left. I'm grateful for the things I've brought with me. I'm also grateful for a lot of things I left behind, but it was a process for sure to get there.
Yeah.
I actually remember a room that I left. I remember calling Matt, you, and being like, what do I do? Just tell me. Just tell me. Paul and I what to do. And you were like, thankfully, you were wise enough to be like, nope, that's not how it works. and there's a discernment process. And Emily, you lay out a process of discernment with the acronym PRAY in your book. Point and call, remember your past, acknowledgement, acknowledged presence, and yield to the arrows. And much of your book picks these pieces of discernment and walks the reader through it. And so I'm just wondering, maybe just pick a point and call and give our listeners kind of this idea. Can you walk us through what point and call is briefly?
So that's really a concept that comes from the Japanese railway system of pointing and calling, which if you've read Atomic Habits, James Clear talks about this process in his book about habit building. But the idea is simply that the Japanese railway system is actually known as the safest in the world. And it's in part because of the practice they have of pointing and calling, which is where the railway workers simply, they kind of embody the instructions of what they're doing. So rather than just reading the sign, like the train's leaving the station, they point to it and they say out loud that the train is leaving the station. They're keeping the passengers safe. They will say out loud what the speed of the train is. They will say and point with their bodies different aspects of the train and what's happening. And in some ways, it's almost like this is what toddlers do when they're playing, like ball, dog, walk, hi, mommy. But in many ways, it has actually worked. That this, when they implemented this process, it's really, I think there's safety, the the statistic is something like 85% of workplace errors were reduced after this system was implemented. But the way I think of that in decision-making is so many times we try to make a decision like in a vacuum, like, well, here's a decision I have to make. So what's the right thing to do? Well, let's first look at where are you now? Let's point and call at what is true. And so I like to offer people, to me, it's so much better, more generative to ask questions rather than make statements. And so I have in the book, I share 10 questions, but you know, there's a million that we could ask ourselves in order to get honest about what is true here right now. For example, if you're just questioning a room of your life and you're wondering, is it time for me to leave? Or is it, do I need to stay and maybe make a change? And one question you could ask yourself is, are there corners of this room that I'm avoiding where I have I'm hesitating to turn on the lights? And if so, what are they? Yeah. What have I been avoiding? What have I not been talking about? And by the way, without judgment, like can we allow ourselves space to just say what is without passing moral judgment or criticizing ourselves for not having talked about that thing that we've been avoiding for 2 years? Yeah. And just letting it be with a point and call, what is, what's happening now? Who's here now? Who's already left? And that's, I have found just that to be a really hopeful, difficult practice, but also one that's extremely honest. And I think it's really the only place to begin when it comes to these big decisions.
Yeah. The compassionate curiosity without judgment is so helpful. Because I think a lot of times when we're in rooms and we're wondering if we need to stay or leave, for me at least, I'm so judgmental of myself.
Right.
And so I think it's really important and a great beginning to discerning what to do next.
Yeah. I'm glad that you shared that, Emily. I think I've recognized that habit as one of the key habits that in my life that I've had to learn is just facing those dark corners, you know. And again, I think the freedom in it has been, oh, I don't need to judge and evaluate whether this is good or bad or whether I'm an idiot or, you know, like that doesn't need an answer. That question doesn't need an answer. I can just look at this because it's real and look at it with some compassion and just see, like, what is the story that I'm tempted to believe here about myself? And I can just look at that as a story. That's just a story about, it's not necessarily true, but it is a story. And that's why I'm scared to look in this corner, but I have to look, you know, in this corner just to see what's real and reckon with it and trust that God's going to meet us in that place.
I have so much compassion for that story, like you said, Ben, that I think so many times in decision-making, the underlying question we're asking is, there's a couple. One is, am I actually an idiot?
Right.
And another one is, am I going to be okay?
Yeah. Yeah.
And decisions, so often we feel the weight of the world on our shoulders. Like if I turn to the right, I might be an idiot and I'm not going to be okay. And if I turn to the left, that's the answer. You know, what I'm always trying to remind myself of, and also when I have conversations like this, is that what if we're not an idiot no matter what we choose?
Right.
And what if we're going to be okay and God will be with us no matter which way we turn?
Yeah.
What if that's true? And I find that to be, sometimes I doubt that that could possibly be true, but I hold great hope that it is.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's the only way to do it is just to say, well, what if I just behaved as if it's true and try that for a week, you know, see, how, yeah. you know, see.
I love that. Let's try it for a week.
Yeah. Just for a week. Maybe I'm not an idiot. If I can believe that for a week, then maybe I can believe it for another week later. So, I wonder if you can talk about the difference. You know, I'm thinking about in my own life, there are situations, relationships, locations, jobs that I've chosen to leave. And then there are those where I was kicked out or forced to leave. You know, there's external pressures or circumstances that make it impossible to stay. And so I wonder if you could talk about the difference between those two situations, just in terms of how we deal with it or how we think about that. You know, your book is a lot about, you know, when we're choosing to leave, but I wonder also about some of those situations where we don't really have a choice and we need to leave, you know?
I think the heartbreak is different. when you are kind of kicked out or you recognize that you're forced out.
Yeah.
I would also say before, you know, one of the stories that I tell, a big part of our family story is we left a church. And before we chose to leave our church, I may have looked at people, I may or may not have looked at people who left thinking like, well, but you left though. Like you could have stayed, but you chose to leave. So therefore, whatever comes with leaving, like not that I didn't have compassion for it, but there was, I didn't get it fully. Like whatever choice you made for leaving, like, but that's what you wanted. So you can't be too sad about it because what you chose.
Right.
But on the other side of it, you know, when we left our church, the reality that I had to come to grips with is that we desperately wanted to stay.
Yeah.
Is that we actually wished it had been a place where we could stay, is that we knew we needed to leave, but we didn't want to. And in fact, I would go so far to say that we didn't so much feel like we were leaving our church, but we felt like our church had left us.
Sure.
And so what do you do when a room that you helped to build with both your time and your money and your efforts and your communities, and you had imagined a future there, when you can no longer call that space home, but it's not because you don't want to. And I think that in a way, even though we made the decision to leave, there was a part of that, you know, our experience of that decision felt like we were forced out, even though that wasn't the story at all. No one would have, you know, they wanted us to, you know, that was not the thing, but that's how it felt. And so I think that it's not a binary, like, well, when we're forced to leave and then when we choose to leave. It's like sometimes these lines are really blurred and the experience of the person leaving, just note for everyone around, it might feel like an abandonment, even though it looks like they're the ones walking out.
And now a word from a sponsor.
This message comes from BetterHelp. Can you think of a time when you didn't feel like you could be yourself? Like you were hiding behind a mask? At work, in social settings, around your family? BetterHelp Online Therapy is convenient, flexible, and can help you learn to be your authentic self, so you can stop hiding. Because masks should be for Halloween fun, not for your emotions. Take off the mask with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
All right, let's get back into our conversation.
A lot of our listeners in the last 8 years have either left a church, made a decision to leave a church, or had the church make the decision for them that they had to leave. Or, sometimes it's a combination, right? And I think it can be particularly difficult because of, like you mentioned at the beginning of our chat today, about the kind of belonging and identity we get from certain associations, certain groups that we're in. I wonder if you could say a bit about grief and the grief associated with leaving. What words, use the metaphor of like, we used the metaphor a little bit ago of a parent just telling us what to do, but I wonder if you could maybe be a parent who helps us understand how grief plays a part in all this?
I think at least in our Western culture, we're pretty comfortable with the expression of joy, which is laughter, which is, you know, we see it on our faces. It's like joy. We like that. We are less comfortable with the natural expression of grief, which would be lament, which would be possibly tears, which could sometimes look like overfunctioning. You know, I think that we have these certain ideas of what grief looks like, but grief wears a lot of faces. And we would do well to begin to learn our own ways that we carry or don't carry our own grief. But when it comes to leaving spaces and even walking into new ones, I don't think we can have an honest conversation about it unless we get real about grief.
Yeah.
And about how it is not something, I think a lot of us are uncomfortable with it, with what it can bring up in us, because sometimes mm-hmm. maybe we're afraid that if we admit that it's there, that maybe we made a wrong choice, mm-hmm. or that, if this was the right choice, then I wouldn't be so sad about it. And I just think that's baloney, to borrow a word from my dad. I think sometimes the deeply right thing can be the most filled with the most grief. And it doesn't mean you made a wrong choice. I think we have a weird relationship to what it means to experience peace. And then we think if grief is present, then it must mean that peace is not. But peace is hard won. And it is something that is not, you know, folded hands in a quiet room. Like, peace often comes on the other side of some type of war, as much as we hate to say internal war or whatever it is we're going through. And I think to associate discomfort with wrong choices is a mixed up idea of what it means to do our next right thing.
Yeah. I think probably for me, but also for our listeners, there's a lot of grief in once the decision has been made, right? And then like you're like, oh, okay, like this is going to be the choice. This is what we're deciding. But you use the metaphor of a hallway and kind of this in between of leaving a place and joining another place. And I found that there was tons of grief in the hallway, so to speak. And I believe that God is doing work in us in the hallway. But I wonder if maybe you could just speak for a second about kind of how do you know it's time to actually leave the hallway? Like in the process, even of grieving in the hallway and then moving to join some other group or friendship or whatever job. And I don't know, just maybe double click on that for us for a second.
The hallway can feel like and is in many ways a liminal space. It's an in-between space.
Yeah.
But I also have learned, it's been really helpful for me to recognize and name the hallway is a place too, that this is actually a location. And it can help us feel a little less untethered because if we think that the only answer is to, I left a room, I have to quick find a new one, we might rush into a room before it's time and not allow the hallway to do the work the hallway wants to do in us. And so recognizing like, oh, the hallway is a place too. And in fact, there may be some areas of your life where you're in a hallway for a really long time. Sometimes we die in hallways. It happens. And so the goal is not in every area to find all the right rooms and to paint the walls the colors that we like and to lock the doors, but that we're always going to be moving in and out of rooms. And some area we're going to be in a hallway. And I think it's helpful. That's why the metaphor is helpful, I think, is to think about what areas of my life am I in a room where I feel great in? Where am I in a hallway where I'm in between things? And then where am I maybe entering something new right now? Probably that's true for all of us at all times.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I remember being in my mid-20s and realizing that I had narrated my life as one long hallway for a good 15 years, you know, waiting to graduate, waiting to get a job, waiting to get married, waiting to have kids, waiting to buy a house. And I was always in between things. And so part of my growth at that time was to realize I actually need to name and own point and call the rooms that I'm in, because life can just feel like this indeterminate time of waiting and being between things. And so I think the language is helpful. And it also indicates, I think the book, Emily, is not just for people obviously facing decisions that they need to make, but it's for people to gain more agency and access to the life they have by naming and locating themselves. Where am I? And how do I live faithfully here? I'm not sure if that was your intent of the book, but that's the gift that I took from it.
So, I love that gift.
Okay. It's always good if it's simpatico with the author, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. If you want, you can go around and tell people what my book's about. That would be great. Well, and it reminds me, Ronald Rollheiser is a Roman Catholic priest, and he says, we get into trouble whenever we don't name things properly. And I have found that to be such excellent life advice, because sometimes half or the full battle is just naming the thing in a way that's true. I might not like what I see. I might not like where I recognize that I am, but I think there is power in naming it. And so thank you, Ronald Rollheiser, for that direction.
Yeah. Yeah. And thank you, Emily, for this book. Again, the title again is How to Walk into a Room, The Art of Knowing When to Stay and When to Walk Away. Tell us a bit about your podcast, The Next Right Thing.
So I started this podcast 7 years ago thinking I would have 10 episodes. And here we are 7 years later with over 300 episodes. But I was just, I mean, really the reason I started it was I was endlessly fascinated with what with the power of an unmade decision and how unmade decisions won't leave us alone until we face them and do something with them. And that process of facing them and how we all decide to face or not face is fascinating to me. It's a conversation I could have forever. And I think there's so much in there that of formation that happens when we have decisions to make. If you think about when we have grown the most, when you look back and you have these moments of ahas or epiphanies, so often you can tie them to a decision you had to make or a decision that was made for you or some type of decision making. And so I feel like that this concept of making decisions and also just taking that advice that has been given, obviously I didn't come up with do the next right thing. This is Martin Luther King Jr., Elizabeth Elliot said it, Anne Lamott, many people before me. It's even, you look at scripture and Jesus lived the next right thing kind of life. If you look at the way he planned out his days in ministry, it's like, oh, that brother was next right thinging his way through the Gospels, through his life. And so when I look at that, I'm like, okay, there is some really interesting connection between just do the next right thing and the freedom that that brings, but also this colossal pressure we put on ourselves to like make the quote unquote right decision.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it was Dallas Willard who said like what matters more than the decision that you make is the person you're becoming. And so that's what I'm so fascinated with that. And so I just keep talking about it on the Next Right Thing podcast.
That's great. So it's a companion sort of media to this book. It sounds like both are sort of admonishing us and exhorting us in a gentle way to take seriously the sanctification through these daily decisions, coming and going, leaving and staying, and what to do in between. Emily, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
One of the things that I wanted to ask Emily about when it comes to these kinds of situations, you know, when it's time to leave, is just the role of community and other people in our discernment. I came out of a tradition, the charismatic church kind of tradition, where hearing from God was like the one thing that would, you know, be a surefire, like that's how that it's, you know, that God is leading you to do something. But that was like a purely internal thing, right? It was like, if I'm going to hear from God, it happens like inside of my individual relationship with God. And so one of the things that I've, you know, learned and grown into since then is to involve other people in my discernment and ask them, you know, well, what do you think? And we have conversations where hopefully, you know, discernment, you know, we can discern together how the Holy Spirit's at work, that kind of thing. But anyway, I wanted to ask her about it because I think, you know, I can think of times in my life where my discernment has been helped by the involvement of other people. And then I can also think of other times in my life where it hasn't been, where people's input has not been helpful, whether that's because they don't, you know, they have a vested interest in me making a certain decision and not another one, you know, or all kinds of other factors. But anyway, I wanted to ask her about that just to see, yeah, what her thoughts are on. I know there's probably no scientific equation to figure that out, but I wondered, you know, what the principles were and that kind of thing. So what do you guys think about that in terms of like, how do we know when to involve people, or how do we know when other people's input is helpful and when it's not so helpful?
You know, the first thing that comes to mind, Ben, is just like the point and call that she talked about of being mm-hmm. compassionately curious and naming what is. I think that when we go to somebody because we have a decision to make and we're asking their advice and their input, it's helpful if they do that for us. Like if they're compassionately curious on our behalf, and then same if someone's coming to me and asking for discernment, for me just to be compassionately curious to what their situation is, because I have a narrative, I have a story that is in my mind, and I don't want to just say the thing. I think it's helpful to be curious and loving and ask the question rather than make the statement. I think that's the way that we need to begin.
Yeah.
That's really good. Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to ask her what happens when we make a decision to leave or to join or to stay? And it's in contradiction to what our friends have said.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
I come from a part of my Christian faith and tradition where communal discernment was really important, but oftentimes in its most unhealthy embodiment, it was codependency and groupthink, you know, where no one could really own what they wanted. And what happened was it was very easy to manipulate and control people in that environment. I think the other ditch then is, like you said, Ben, a bunch of individuals just hearing from the Lord and doing what they want. And it does feel like there's something, I don't know if I want to say in between that or something different that we strive to.
Well, it's not the decision, right? It's the process. It's the journey. And if we go to another person, like even in my situation, Matt, I remember calling you and being like, what do I do? Just tell me what Paul and I should do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And
do you remember what I said?
I mean, you just asked a bunch of questions. Okay. I don't remember you ever being, I don't know, maybe you did, but I do remember being annoyed at how many questions that you asked, because I think you understood that it's a journey and I would be missing out, so to speak, in what I think God wanted to do in me if I was just told an answer, right?
Yeah.
You're thinking. Do you not agree with that? It's okay
no,
if you don't.
No, I totally do. I think, though, that it's not just questions by themselves. It's not just asking questions as a static category of, but it's rather like, I think what we're talking about here is kind of what we train people to do in our Gravity Formation course, which is I was trying to trust God is present at work in Christy's life and that we don't need to solve this or fix this or manufacture something, but rather we need to uncover or excavate or discover what God is doing. And sometimes that takes a lot of time, and sometimes that takes not a lot of time. Sometimes that takes one question. Sometimes that takes 100. But I really was trying to leverage that kind of faith on our behalf in that convo. Yeah. I think God's present at work here. I don't think I'm the oracle from which he's working. and can we discover this together? Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to say that too.
Yeah.
Which I think Emily would obviously agree with that as well.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, as part of it, this is maybe what you mean by, you know, it's the process, not the decision, maybe, but you know, God's present and at work in more than just, you know, choice A or choice B.
Right.
Like the point isn't like, oh, how do we quickly get to the decision point as quickly as possible? Even though it feels that way, right? Because, you know, it just inherently there's anxiety when I don't know what to do. But God's doing a lot more than just moving me towards a decision. Mm-hmm. God is at work in all kinds of other ways. And, you know, and I think that there is something helpful about what you said, Matt, about, you know, the two ditches. My mind often goes there in these kinds of situations to say, well, I know one ditch and I know this other ditch. And so maybe those, they end up being almost like guardrails to be like, okay, like there's a maybe a ton of space in between. And like you said, maybe the middle isn't the best metaphor, but maybe it works here. But like, if these are the guardrails where it's like, well, I definitely don't want to be involved in just groupthink where it's like, oh, I have to take everybody's input equally and I can't make this decision unless everybody agrees with it and affirms it 100%, you know, seven times. And then the other ditch of, I'm just going to pray about it. And as soon as I feel certain in my heart, I'm just going to do it come hell or high water. Mm. And there's some space in there between those two things to trust people who know how to ask questions that help me point and call. I think that was another helpful thing that you said, Christy, is it's not so much advice from people like, here's what I think you should do, but it's more seek out people that you trust to help you like get into the corners that maybe you didn't even realize, oh, I haven't even dug all the way into that corner and I didn't even realize that I was avoiding it until you asked that question, you know, or people who can maybe point things out that we have blind spots about,
yeah.
You know, like, oh, well, I notice you say this a lot, or I notice that you like these kinds of activities, or I notice that you, you know, complain about this a lot, you know, that kind of a thing can oftentimes help us to see the situation and see ourselves more clearly. And again, to bring it back into the Gravity Formation course, God's meets us in that reality. And I think that oftentimes our discernment about what God's doing comes right on the heels of us just naming what's real.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, our hearts and the situation and all of that kind of stuff. Yep. The discernment doesn't feel that hard after we can name what's real.
You guys are good at that. You guys are like, I think that is like really good friendship, honestly. Yeah. And so I guess what I'm saying is like, I think you guys are good friends to me because I think you do that just naturally. I'm the type of person that I just want like A or B, like one or two, like pick the thing. When I'm done with one room, I want to shut the door and lock it and be like, holy cow, that's over, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. Or here's the new room and I'm just all in. Like, and I just think you're really good at like in the hallway, in whatever room I'm in, you know, whatever situation, God meets us there. And you guys have been good friends to ask the question. So thank you.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for sharing that.
Thanks, Christy. That means a lot.
Yeah.
I appreciate you. You also are really good at like affirming people that you love. You're a champion of people. You do this a lot. And sometimes it's, with some people, it's sort of cringy or forced, but with you, it's just like, I don't know. I love how you enthuse other people.
It's not cringy.
At all. It's not cringy at all. I don't know. Sometimes when I try to pay a compliment, it's like, is that really a compliment? Did you sneak in a critique? You know, like, do you believe what you're saying? And I just never think that with you, Christy.
So Christy, you should record that. And just, if your kids ever accuse you of being cringe, I think that's a thing kids say. Yeah. If you just say, I'm not cringe. My friend told me.
Let me see if I can.
And they'll be like, is your friend a boomer? And you could say, no, he's Gen X.
All right. Let me see if I can do something similar, Christy. Then I have something for you.
Okay. Is this going to be cringe? Okay.
State gives you the smallest beverages?
Minnesota.
Minnesota.
But
that was just for you, Ben. Mm-hmm. Ben's from Minnesota.
Figured it out right away.
Did you?
Probably have heard that one before.
Wow.
Minnesota. Although the irony is, when I grew up in Minnesota, and you didn't call
big
it
gulps.
Soda.
Only big
you call
gulps.
It pop.
That's right.
Pop.
That's right.
Yeah.
My mom.
So yeah. I only started calling it soda when I think it's called here in Indiana. It's called soda sometimes. Every once in a while, called pop, but most of the time, I think it's soda.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go to the South, and I was so confused for a little while because they call it Coke.
Yeah, everything's a Coke.
Everything's what kind of a Coke.
Do you want?
You know, so I was like, yeah, what kind of Coke do you want? I was like, what? Yeah. I just thought I just ordered Coke.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. All right, everybody.
Glad we cleared that up. What do you
call?
Go drink
some pop. Michigan people call it pop. Colorado. I grew up
pop.
Anything. They can call it whatever they want in Colorado.
I'm one of the, I grew up in Indiana and we called it Coke.
Oh,
Wow.
Because of the
South Side.
Because of South Side. Upper Appalachia, baby.
Yeah. There's parts of Indiana's a funny little state. So all right. Well, I think we covered
we'll see
it.
See you next time.
Adios, muchachos.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity Commons. It's free to join, and you can connect with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith, spirituality, and whatever else comes up. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sturkey and Matt Tebby. Aaron Sturkey edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsturkey.com. We'd love to hear from you. To record a question or a comment for us, go to gravitycommons.com/message and click Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.
Percent of the work week is spent communicating, typing, talking, and going back and forth on topics until everyone is on the same page. It's time for a change. It's time for Grammarly. Grammarly's AI ensures your team gets the point across the first time, eliminating misunderstandings and streamlining collaboration. It goes beyond basic grammar to help tailor writing to specific audiences. Whether that means adding an executive summary, fine-tuning tone, or cutting out jargon in just one click. 4 out of 5 professionals say Grammarly's AI boosts buy-in and moves work forward. It integrates seamlessly with over 500,000 apps and websites, is implemented in days, and is IT approved. Join over 70,000 teams and 30 million people who trust Grammarly to elevate their communication. Visit grammarly.com/enterprise to learn more. Grammarly. Enterprise ready AI.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be.